She was anxious, tense, and obviously bewildered. She told me that her son had been at her, berating her for some time because of contributions that she was making to the United Torch and other charities that she considered worthwhile. He was telling her that these charities were nothing but band-aids, that they covered over and masked social ills, and that what the society needed was radical political and economic surgery, and she was only delaying, making more difficult that surgery. Her daughter had been home. She was in love, or so she told her mother. She was living with another graduate student, and they had a very wonderful relationship. But they were not about to be married. Marriage, she told her mother, would have sullied somehow the wonderful purity of their relationship. What they had now was genuine. What they would have if they were married was something less. Her brother and her sister-in-law, after some 16 years of marriage, were being divorced. They were the best of friends, and the marriage had more or less seemed to be working out. But her brother told her that everyone needs to have a new start and begin again. And if they didn't do it now, it'd be too late soon. And then the night before, her husband had come home. And he told her that she should pack, that they were going to travel around the country for a while. He was tired of the business that they'd worked so hard over the long years to build up. Someone else would take it over, and whatever they could get out of it, they would get out of it. He wanted to see the country before it was too late, and perhaps they'd end up living in California. She shook her head. She looked at me, a little bit whipped, puzzled, bewildered. I just don't know what's right anymore. Now, every one of us, given the confusions of life today, has found ourselves shaking our head in similar bewilderment when someone we love, someone dear to us, makes a decision which to us seems unaccountable or irresponsible. Certainly not the decision that we would make if we were in the same place. I remember a father who came home from visiting his two recently grown-up children in San Francisco, who looked at me and said, Rabbi, either the whole world's crazy or I am. And I think many of us, given this battering of conflicting moral and ethical judgments, finding that so many others choose so many different ways to live than we might choose or we would choose, have more or less been driven back into ourselves, driven to the point where we almost hear ourselves saying, well, anything goes. There's really no way of knowing what's right and what's wrong. We've got to reserve all moral judgments. Now, there's an old rabbinic principle, Al tadin et chavercha et shetagia limkomo, don't judge another until you're in his place. It's good to reserve moral judgments when they're simply judgments of others. But we must live and we must make decisions, and I believe that there are still standards by which decisions can be made. And I'd like to suggest this morning some of the ways in which one can go about dealing with ethics and morals, questions that arise, so that we don't end up, you know, in the position of saying you're right and you're right and you're right too. You remember the old Eastern European folk tale of the rabbi who was sitting in his study with his secretary? When an irate woman burst through the doors and poured out on him a litany of complaint about her husband, the Rebbe tried to get her to sit down. But she was filled with anger. Her husband was arrogant. Her husband was cold to her. Her husband was careless of the children. She couldn't trust her husband any longer. And the rabbi kept saying to her, "You're right, you're right, you're right." And finally, she was quieted and quieted. She left. And a half hour later, there's another pounding at the door. And this time it was the husband, and he had his full chronicle of complaints. His wife was a shrew, and she was bitter and vindictive, and she was careless around the house, and the cooking was no good. And the rabbi kept saying to him, "You're right, you're right, you're right." And he finally calmed her down, calmed him down, and finally he left. And the secretary, who had watched this performance, these two performances, finally turned to his master and teacher, and he said, "Rebbe, they can't both be right." And he, of course, answered to secretary, "And you're right, too." A while back, an elderly woman came to me with bitter complaint about her children. They were insisting that she register in Menorah Park. Now, this wonderful old lady had been raised in the era of the extended family, when families kept their own at home. And I remember her saying to me, don't my children know the Ten Commandments? Honor your father and your mother. How can they do this to me?" And of course, a few hours later, the children were in my office. And they had investigated all of the homes that were available, and of course they'd found Menorah Park to be a very fine institution. Both of them worked. There was no chance of keeping their mother at home. She needed a certain kind of custodial care. She sometimes wandered off, and she wasn't quite sure where she was. She'll be taken care of. We've always been close. We'll visit her. We have no other choice, given our lives and our society. You're right, and you're right. And a day or two later, I got a call on the phone from the granddaughter. The granddaughter was very much disturbed and perturbed at her parents. How could they put her grandmother in a home? A home was an institution. Institutions depersonalize and dehumanize a human being. Don't I know that? How could they do this to her grandmother? You're right, and to a certain degree, you're right, too. And so many of us, as we listen to the generations struggling with the massive structural changes in family life and the social order, find ourselves listening to a lot of people who know they're right, and wondering deep inside ourselves, what is right? How do I know what is the good thing to do, the right and appropriate and proper and responsible thing to do? We know deep down that the old may have been right in another society, but is not necessarily right today. And we know deep down that the new, those who want to do the different thing, are not always right simply because they're insisting on their right to be different. We know that there are a whole series of questions that what must be asked, but we find it difficult to think the issue through. There's a whole question of motivation. Was the son berating his mother for contributing to charity because he had studied the economic order, because he was a convinced revolutionary, and because he believed deep down that there was no other way to establish justice in the community than through some kind of radical political reform? Or was he simply strutting like a peacock, determined some way or other to find anger in his parents, to find a reason to put them down? And was the daughter making such a fetish about not marrying her young man because she, in fact, believed that introducing lifelong vows and the law into their relationship would somehow sully it? or because she was afraid deep down that if she began to talk to her young man about marriage, about lifelong vows, he might prove skittish and move away. There's a question of the calculus of consequence of what we do. If the family had, in fact, sufficiency, if the years had not only allowed them to provide for the years, but to put a little bit aside so that whatever happened in the next 10 or 15 years, the father and the mother would have enough, whether they sold the business today or 10 years from now, then the decision of the husband to find some years where he didn't have to work 6 days a week and 12 or 14 hours a day makes sense. He's finding his own Sabbath in life. But if, in point of fact, he was simply acting out of impetuosity because he saw others doing it, because he felt middle age passing him by before he had an opportunity to live without thought to how they would live and survive as they aged, that's another matter. There are all kinds of conditions that must be considered when we deal with moral judgments. They're not easy. The search for a definition of what is right, of the good, is one of the oldest philosophic pursuits of man. It was begun, of course, in the academies of Greece. At least it's best known to us for beginning in those academies, 2,500 years ago. Plato, you'll recall, began to investigate the nature of the good. He decided that he could define the good in terms of four cardinal virtues, each of which conformed to some idealized form. But I remember being puzzled as I read through Greek philosophy, particularly as I read Plato, that having defined the good in a way which he found satisfactory, Plato had done so little that I would call active goodness. What did he do with his definition of the good? Did he go out into the agora of Athens and preach to the Athenians about their sins? Did he get up in the council of Athens and tell them that slavery was evil, that they ought to free all who lived among them? Not at all. Having defined the good, Plato simply continued to live as he had lived before, teaching the sons of the well-born by discussion and by philosophic analysis about the nature of the beautiful or the nature of the good or the nature of justice. The Chinese, I'm told, define ethics with an ideogram which consists of the shape of a man and the symbol for the number two, which I'm told suggests the idea that ethics exists only in relationship to others, that one proves one's virtue not by the subtlety of one's definition of the good, but by the quality of the life which we lead. That ethics does not exist apart from acts and deeds which have consequence. I remember when I was an undergraduate at college, I took a course from a very fine philosopher, Ralph Barton Perry, on moral philosophy. It was one of the more important philosophic inquiries of my life. But as so often at college, the senior philosopher teacher gave the lectures, and there was an instructor who once a week came with the undergraduates and talked with us about what we had learned. Now, this particular young man obviously knew most of what was needed to be known about the analysis of the definition of the good in world philosophy. But he was a sadist. Instead of listening to undergraduates fumbling with their first attempts to understand how philosophy is done and what is the good, he sat there delighting to tear us down and to tear us to shreds. And he did so, of course. He was trained and we were neophytes. He knew all about the good, but he was not a good man. A great deal of moral philosophy exists, But one of the things I've always felt most important to consider is the authenticity, that is the character, the experience, the quality of the person who speaks about the good or the right or the ought. When I hear youngsters pontificate about righteousness, I sometimes find myself wondering, for all of their noble enthusiasm, what is their mandate? And when I hear wisdom from those who have used power with some degree of effect and some degree of humility and some degree of effective and good consequence, I listen much more attentively. They've earned the right to speak of the good and the necessary and the right. So one of my first criteria in deciding what goes is to listen to the person who's talking about it and to judge the words by the speaker. The granddaughter who was telling me how terrible institutions were was simply repeating some of the cant about institutions, which is common knowledge in her age group. And she was allowing herself a little bit of emotional display. She was, in a sense, enjoying her self-righteousness. Now, there was something to what she said. Institutions can be dehumanizing places. But she'd not investigated the institution. She'd not thought about the consequences of not enrolling her grandmother in Menorah Park. All she had thought about was her own emotional enthusiasms. I want to introduce you to a man, because I want to quote two lines from one of his works, who you may or may not have heard of. His name is Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Dietrich Bonhoeffer was born in Germany in 1906, and he was hung by the Nazis in 1945. Bonhoeffer was a child of privilege who found his way back into the ministry of the evangelical church in Germany, to which his family belonged. He served as a parish priest. But his mind was keen, and he soon became one of the leading intellectuals and theologians of Germany, and one of the most respected men in Protestant theology in Europe. In 1938, he was invited by the Union Theological Seminary in New York to come to New York to join its faculty. He came to New York, and he taught. In 1939, when he felt war was imminent, he left the United States and left that security to go back to his people, to go back to Germany, where he worked in a parish and he encouraged his people. And while the war began, he was silenced by the Nazis, forbidden the right to preach or to teach. For a while, he continued in his ministries in his parish, and he began to write a book on ethics. The book was never fully completed. When he was incarcerated, jailed by the Nazis in 1943, and finally hung by them 2 years later. In this little volume on the ethics, he has a chapter called History and Good. And I'd like to read two lines of it to you. Two lines written by a man living under the shadows, writing from his gut, writing the kind of material that we have to listen to. The question of the good always finds us already in a situation which can no longer be reversed. We are alive. The question of good is posed and is decided in the midst of each definite, yet unconcluded, unique, and transient situation of our lives. In the midst of our living relationships with men, things, institutions, and powers. In other words, in the midst of our historical experience. What Bonhoeffer is saying here is that there is no such thing as the good in the abstract. Mankind's long attempt, begun by the Greeks, to define the good, the right, the ought, is essentially a hapless enterprise because there is no such thing as goodness outside of, external to the deed itself. To understand what is good, you must look at a concrete situation about the times, the family, the context, the relationships, the culture in which a particular decision must be made and is made, and in which the consequences of that decision will be played out. To read this paragraph is to understand and appreciate something that's rather unique in the literature of our Jewish people. There is very little philosophy or philosophizing about the good among Jews. Oh, occasionally among medieval philosophers, you'll find a chapter or two by a Sadia or someone else in which he gives a slightly Judaized version of Aristotelian ethics. But by and large, the way in which Jews went about the process of determining what is right was through a literature which is called the responsa. We would call it today case histories. A rabbi would have a particularly difficult issue presented to him, and he would draw up a digest of the problem. And he might or might not append his own comments on the issues. And then he would send around this case to other authorities of the day for their comment. No one expected there to be only one answer. What was looked for was enlightenment, insight, sensitivity. And the case would go the rounds and become part of the legal and ethical literature of our people. The older I get, the more I appreciate one of the traditions of our people, which says, Elu ve'elu divrei Elohim chayim, this and the other can both be the part of the wisdom of the living God. There can be, in ethical questions, differences of opinion, because these questions are complex and difficult. The very best. If in fact then, there is no such thing in the abstract as the good, to understand ethics is always to find the most complete understanding of a problem that we can derive. The first step in any kind of decision making is to try to analyze as fully as we can our motives, the issues, and the possible consequences. And obviously that's a very difficult undertaking. We are blind to many of our motives. We are always unaware of some of the issues. And the future is, of course, to a large degree, closed to us. Nevertheless, this is the process through which we must go. Impulse is not the way. Often by impulse we're moved to do something which in fact may be very dangerous to do. Unlike other ethical traditions, ours is not one which praises the kind of innocent, childish saint. We have no saints really. But the sensitive moral person is the one who considers what they do and then does it. I watched the other day a child injure himself slightly on the play yard. He was lying there on his back. And the nursery school teacher raced out and scooped the child up with an instinctive act of love. But I didn't know if the child had hurt his back. And if his back was hurt, that scooping up in love might have had unfortunate consequences for the child. Learning, awareness, all of these must play their role in decision making. We've lost in our 20th century the feeling that there are any abstract standards which are always and universally true by which we can follow and organize our lives. been very personal today, but somehow talking of ethics requires one to be personal, to draw the experience out of one's own life. I remember, some time ago, being in the hospital, and I went from one room to another, and I found that the decision I made in the second room was diametrically opposed to the decision that I made in the first, though the problem on the surface was the same, the problem of fatal illness. I walked into the first hospital room. There was a man in bed. He was in his middle age. He looked up at me. And he said, "You know, Rabbi, I've been very sick, but I feel better now, and I know that I'm going to be well." He knew he wasn't going to be well, but he was denying it. And I looked at him. A lot of thoughts raced through my mind, and I said, "No, you're not." And we talked. Here was a man who had a wife, children, business. If he denies, if he pushes off, all kinds of decisions which needed to be made would not have been made. And in a sense, he needed to be forced to confront an ugly reality, a painful reality. Down the hall, there was an older person, ill also with cancer, also with a limited time. And I remember that she spoke to me with almost the same words. "I've been very sick, but I'm beginning to feel a little bit better. And I know that all this will soon be behind me and I'll be well." And I was very comforting and very solicitous. And I did not intrude reality. No one depended on her. There were no decisions that needed to be done that only she could make. She had the opportunity to organize her last days as she wished to have them organized. It's very hard to think that there are any absolute standards outside of the immediate concrete situation. Ethical decisions must be contextual. That is, related to the context of the problem that faces you. Which is to say that one of the reasons that so many people take so very different approaches to problems is that the context in which they see the problem is different than the context in which we see it. That unlike life 2, 3, 5 generations ago, where there was a certain kind of similarity to the experience of each generation now grows up in a radically different world. And the overlay of the historic experience which we carry around with us, what we saw our parents do and somehow were conditioned to believe to be right in their generation and perhaps in ours, may no longer be appropriate in another generation. The question of the institutionalization of the elderly is a classic instance in point. How do we go about making these decisions? There's a man by the name of Joseph Fletcher, teaches ethics in one of the seminaries, the Protestant seminaries, who believes that since there is no such thing as an abstract and acceptable definition of the good, there is no way of bringing any standards to one's judgments except the standards of one's own motivations. If I feel that I'm doing what I'm doing out of love, that it is genuine, that's enough. That defines the good. And he defines therefore the good as acting out of love. And I must confess that when I listen to his definition of the good as acting out of love, I am terribly troubled by it. Because there are all kinds of love. There's a selfless love which is truly beautiful. And there's a selfless love which grows out of a pathological need to be a martyr. There's a mother love which sustains life. And there's a mother's love which is a smothering love. There's a love of self which is becoming pride. There's a love of self, which is simple arrogance. Love covers anything and everything, anything at least that we want it to cover. The pathological who plot to destroy the world do so out of their great love for the world. Love is a very uncertain yardstick. Indeed, all of the great terms of the world, love, peace, justice, all those words which make us respond enthusiastically, are very dangerous terms. In my lifetime, I've heard Stalin speak of peace, and I've heard Hitler speak of peace, and Neville Chamberlain talked of peace in our times. And I've seen young people talk of peace and then do the most unconscionable things. And I've heard four presidents of the United States speak of peace and kill more people in Vietnam. Peace, justice, freedom, love, all these, the grand words of human civilization, mean nothing unless you understand who is saying it, the context in which it's being said, and the consequences of the proposals that they are making. How then does one go about thinking even about the right and the good, and if there is no abstract, the good? We can deal only of goodness in terms of the deed, the concrete situation. I can only tell you how I go about it. There are two great symbols in my life. One is a symbol of Sinai, and the other is the symbol of the Promised Land. To me, Sinai represents the gracious gift by God of a definition of the good. For reasons which I do not understand, but for which I'm ultimately and totally grateful, God decided to interrupt the universal human confusion and to offer us mitzvot, commandments, a definition of what we must do. See, I have set before you this day the blessing, the curse, life and death. Here it is, the commandments, and do them. No, I do not look upon the mitzvot as they're presented in the Bible as eternal and immutable laws which I must obey. Maimonides once observed that God gave Israel a whole set of sacrificial laws because this is the only kind of religious structure which the Hebrews of those days would have understood. If he had talked about the synagogue or the Torah or the way we worship, or he worshiped, they would not have understood. God somehow gave man these insights in the terms in which they understood them in their day. And we have a great literature, which we call Torah, the living Torah, in which for 3,500 years our people have tried to take these basic mitzvot and apply them and reapply them in the context of the needs of each successive generation. But there are rights and there are wrongs. We're not ultimately left to the point saying we can't judge another's actions or our own, except were we loving? Were we caring? Did they believe it to be right? If they did, that's enough. It's not right to have no reverence for the life of another. It's not right carelessly, cavalierly to take the life of another. It's not right to be cruel and animalistic about our human relationships. The basic relationships are to be lasting, binding. It's not right to be careless of the gifts of life on this earth with its resource and its plenty which God gave us. We must husband it and be careful stewards of it. There is a right in that sense and there is a wrong. And it's the test of each generation that they use their eyes and their minds to understand what these basic truths, these mitzvot, require of them in their generation as a response. We can't talk of tithing anymore as a way of taking care of the poor. We can talk of the appropriate kinds of social welfare legislation in a modern state, and it's one and the same thing. The Bible in its day could not do away entirely with slavery. But God defined himself as the God who brought the Hebrews out of bondage, out of slavery. And the Hebrew law set very definite limits as to the length of bondage into which anybody could be kept. 6 years, and the seventh year, the slave was to be set free. We've long gone beyond the point where labor has to be organized according to the old system of the slave. And we certainly can think of freedom, of the freedom of all men from bondage to being wage slaves, to being slaves to work which is brutal or dehumanizing, as a goal towards which we must be tending. There is a right. There are certain basic traditions which were given to us at Sinai about community and about human dignity, about the requirement to make life sacred, consecrated, which remain as alive to us today as they must have been in a very specific context to our fathers. That's the image of Sinai. And the image of the promised land says two things to me. That mankind is on the way and he's not yet in the messianic age. So much of the moralizing that I hear about me in my age, in our age, is moralizing as if we had entered utopia. As if all things were possible. And all things are not possible. The parents had no alternative but to place their elderly mother in an institution. It was not the best of all possible solutions. It was the one that was appropriate to them. It is not the best of all appropriate solutions to spend billions of dollars for a military budget, and much of it may be misspent. But certainly given the world as it is, it would be an act of folly simply to say, we alone among the nations of the world will not defend our freedoms and our homes and our lives from the predatory enemies who exist out there. We live in the very real world. We are on the way, not yet in the promised land. But we are on the way. And every moral decision we make must be made by standards which are more than prudential. How do I make out? They must be made in terms of our own growth, of opening up ourselves to others, of making it possible for our community to become a juster place or a freer society or a more open society. There must always be a time element in which we think of how we will, by this decision, transcend the limitations which surround us now. That's hope. That's promise. That's the sense of holy purpose. Somehow or other, when I face whatever the decisions that we all face in our lives, that I face very privately as you face yours, I find that these two great symbols, the symbol of Sinai and the symbol of the promised land, provide me with balance, a sense of purpose, and a sense of direction and of hope. Why is the problem so difficult for us? Not so long ago, Israel lived in a world in which the law was God's law, clearly defined and articulated as they understood God's law, the halakha. And ethics was simply the acceptance of this holy practice in what was called lifnei v'lifnei mishurat hadin, acts which went beyond that which the law required. Acts which were acts of supererogation. But then we came into the open society and the society of future shock, and the whole sense of that which was appropriate on the basic level of custom, of law, of tradition began to disappear. And now every decision which involves us in any basic way becomes a private ethical decision. Everyone took marriage for granted a generation or two or three ago. Now we have to think through, should we get married? Everyone took family for granted a generation or two or three ago. Now we have to think through, what in fact are my responsibilities to my children and to my parents? When did they begin and when did they end? We knew what a child was a generation or two ago. A child was an economic dependent. And at age 13 or 14, he went out on his own and ceased to be economically dependent. Well, we may have an economic dependent offspring who's studying for a residency in surgery, you know, at the age of 30 or 32. All the complex of parent-child relationships become involved here. We lack what our parents lacked, a cake of custom, of practice, which carries us through, which gives us guidelines, which makes it easier for us, which means to me simply that life is full of greater opportunity for us, there's more choice, and it's more difficult. Ultimately, the ethical question, I guess, is this: are you serious about life? Are you willing to look seriously at each of the opportunities and decisions which confront you? And with respect for yourself and for the needs of others, aware of the possibilities of the moment and the limitations of the moment, concerned with your own growth and the growth of those who are related to you, are you willing to do what you feel needs to be done? Are you listening to Sinai? To the voice that you know to be the commanding voice of God? Are you on the way towards the promised land? A personality which will have developed towards wisdom, towards goodness. See, I have set before ye this day the blessing and the curse, life and death. Choose life. Far more often than our ancestors, that choice is before us. These are difficult choices, but they can be made. Amen.